Building a portfolio with Fidelity Basket Portfolios is kind of like making a sandwich. It's as simple as picking your stocks and ETFs, sort of like your meats and other toppings, and managing it as one big, juicy investment. Mmm, now that's pretty good. Learn more at fidelity.com/baskets. Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE SIPC.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Welcome to Bet the Edge. I'm Jay Crouch and here with Drew Dinsick. Today we're going to do AMA pod show. We will talk about the NBA clutch and most improved player markets. Talk about Man City, Liverpool, repercussions in the Premier League. Off of that, we'll talk some tennis as well. And our good friend, Mr. Denny Carter, will stop by to talk about the Players' Championship. And at the end, we'll talk about Indian Wells. But let's start with a question from at Dan Rosencheck, Drew. DeMar DeRozan has come out of nowhere to be plus 180 or shorter in the clutch player of the year odds. I didn't notice fast enough to hedge my position on the injured Curry. Should I be scared? Curry is minus 180 in the market. DeRozan, to Dan's point, plus 180. Shea is 10-1. And that, I think, realistically ends your list of candidates, unless Damian Lillard comes from the absolute clouds at 25-1. But I don't think that's going to happen. What do you make of this market?
Yeah, I think the big question kind of swirls around, when do we expect Curry back? And do you think that this ankle injury has a lingering impact on him beyond just missing this couple games? I think obviously the Golden State Warriors, also kind of where they land in the standings, is a big aspect here as well. But it's very, very tough for me to wrap my head around this award still. We talked about this a couple weeks ago and I was like, I just don't, there's so little bit of, so little guidance on how you ultimately decide who gets, award like this, that it's, it's just a ton of guesswork. The clutch teams that are playing the most minutes in the clutch are generating the most counting stats, and that's the Warriors and the Bulls. Like, does that mean they're more clutch, or they just happen to be in the clutch more? Like, it's very, very convoluted here. And I think, to answer some of these questions, number one, I think Steph Curry will be back after missing this next game against the Spurs. So I would expect his return on the 13th. But I think the ankle injury to me did not seem significant enough, even though this is a repeat thing for him now, does not seem significant enough that he's going to miss a ton of games down the stretch, just as far as maintenance goes, because the Warriors can't really afford to do that. They can't afford to throw the white flag up in any way, shape, or form and expect to get into the playoff mix. I think that 9-10 game in the West is going to be unbelievable, whoever's in it. And presumably, you don't want to be on the road in that spot playing the likes of the Lakers, where you would be something like, what, a 4.5 point dog. So it's going to be, I think incumbent upon Curry to play out the rest of this season, regardless of what he's dealing with physically. And at that point, I think he's still probably the right player. Do you have a disagreement here? Do you think DeRozan, there's enough ground to make up here? Are the Bulls really going to get an award for clutch?
Such a ridiculous market, Drew. It's a good point. And cheering this market on is just so insane. Like, I'm praying that, players that I'm not on, that the opposing team doesn't cut the score to within five, so it enters into clutch territory in the last 5 minutes. Like, it's just completely ridiculous. I do think that the key thing in terms of handicapping this award is, and I'm hearing this secondhand, but I'm going to take it as truth, that apparently a memo went around the NBA last year to voters about this award. And one thing that was highlighted was total clutch points. And for people who don't know, That is just the total points that you score in the last 5 minutes of a game where the score is within 5 points. That is what clutch time is defined as. And in that department, and that's how 1-2-3 went in clutch player of the year last year, which De'Aaron Fox won. But by that, Stephen Curry is still out in front with 165 points. In the clutch, DeRozan is second with 147. And then there is a massive drop off to Damian Lillard at 115. If Lillard wins this award, it is an absolute travesty. Like, his shooting splits in the clutch are 44-32. Oh, 96% from the line. That's good, Dame. But the 32% from three is not great. He has a good plus minus and they have a good record. But he shouldn't be anywhere near the discussion. It should be Curry or DeRozan. Shea, I think, is the third most likely player to win. I don't think he justifies his market price. I understand that he's shooting 61% from the field in the clutch. He has a great plus minus. He's probably not going to win MVP, so I think people might want to vote for him. Mm-hmm. He's eighth in the league in clutch scoring. He's scored 98 points in the clutch and Curry's at 165. Like, it would be, I think, pretty ridiculous for Shea to win when the counting stat gap is that big. Now, if he bridges it, it'll be a discussion. Someone who's very much on Curry and DeRozan, Shea's a little bit, it's not scary, it's just annoying. Like, I just kind of want it to go away so I don't have to think about it. But I do think ultimately that Curry and DeRozan, because of their gap, are like 95% of this market. In terms of those two against each other, I think the market overcorrected a little bit on DeRozan. I think that, one, Curry still has a gap in the counting stats. If you look at per game stuff as well, like per clutch game, such a ridiculous market, per clutch game, Curry has the gap as well, where DeRozan's played 156 minutes in the clutch and Curry's played 122 and right. Curry still has the lead for counting stats. Curry is shooting 50, 47, 95 in the clutch. And now he's only got a plus three clutch plus minus and DeRozan is plus 72. But I don't know. Does clutch plus minus really matter for this award? Like Kobe White has a much better plus minus in the clutch than DeRozan. Like, where does this factor into it? Like, I think ultimately what is going to happen is, and you've seen like the viral tweets go around about how Curry laps the field with clutch field goals made, clutch three-pointers made. He had the shot, the epic shot against Phoenix to walk them off effectively. I think so long as Curry comes back, and it seems like he will, that he should still win the award. But I thought like 2 weeks ago, whenever we last talked about this, I thought this was pretty close to done. I no longer think it is done, but I still think that Curry, I think he should be more like minus 200 and there is some minus 145 about in the market. So that is my breakdown of clutch player.
They just did get rid of this, guys. What do we...
No, I love
like,
it.
It's no, that, yeah, okay, fine. Keep it. Make more of these crazy, stupid ones. Then. Don't take this as betting advice. The most clutch players, the guys who have played the best in the biggest games at the end of the games.
Jokic.
Second best guys, Shea. You know what? That's your 1 and 2 right now for the MVP. Why do you need another one of these? So yeah, I think I don't know. I don't think ultimately, you know, the they're gonna coalesce around Jokic just because of how good he's been in the very minimal clutch minutes he's played. I think The closing of the gap is DeRozan scored a bunch of points in the clutch to narrow the gap. Because last time we talked about this, it didn't seem even possible to close this gap. He's doing it based on volume of time spent in the clutch. And as long as Curry is healthy and playing, he's still probably going to win.
Yes. No, I am there with you. I think DeRozan should be more in the plus 230 type of range. And his price has gone shorter than that. So I think that Curry is the bet. Price, and then Shea and to a very lesser degree Jokic are the two guys that I would monitor. Like, if Jokic has a game where he scores 19 points in the clutch somehow, an OT game or whatever, then it might become a little bit interesting, but we're not there yet. Also, there is going to be zero campaigning for Nikola Jokic to win Clutch Player of the Year. Absolutely zero. All right, question from at Paul Minju Choi. Magic versus Heat for the division. Starting to see some plus money pop for the Heat. What do you make of this market, Drew? We're recording Monday afternoon. So yesterday, the Magic had a pretty bad loss to the Pacers at home.
Yeah.
But the Heat had a much worse loss home to the Wizards.
Oh, man. The Magic had a chance to put this thing away. The Knicks game was a terrible spot for them. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, I did not expect the Magic to go and beat the Knicks in that just brutal spot, especially with no Suggs and with with the Brunson coming back. Like, that was not a fair fight. They need Suggs back badly, though. My goodness gracious, the guard play this last couple. Oh my goodness, it is it's not good. And you know, I think I'm you know, that of all of the injuries, of all of the bets that I have going right now, the one that I'm the most keyed on is Suggs and his ability to return and help elevate this team, because everything else breaks right for the Magic for the rest of the season. Jay, would you be surprised to know that for the rest of the month of March, they only have one road game, and that game is against the Toronto Raptors, who are doing the exact same travel from Orlando to Toronto to play that game. And so I think ultimately, like, this is as good a setup as you could possibly have to coast this thing in. And as long as they get Suggs back, and he's, you know, as effective a player as we saw, at times this season, then I think we're in good shape. The murkiness around the Suggs injury is tough, though, man. Questionable with a right thigh contusion. That's not one that I have a ton of, like, you know, I can't point to a ton of examples of, like, yeah, this is a 2 or 3 game thing. Like, he should be back. Like, I really don't understand what's happening here, and they need him desperately. Assuming he does come back, though, I make them meaningful favorites over the Heat. It's kind of an interesting mix what's going on right now in 4 through 6 in the East. One of these teams, Knicks, Pacers, Magic, and Heat, is going to be in the play-in. And I don't think the Heat necessarily want to find themselves in the 7. If the Magic and the Heat continue to win, then I do think there's a chance that the Pacers fall down into the 7 the way they're playing basketball right now. And in that world, the Heat aren't taking the end of the season as seriously as the Magic might. So maybe that is just a little bit of an X factor tilting in favor of Orlando. But again, I'm talking my book a bit here. I need them to get this one home. I think the best price I got, when I was really just convicted that the schedule imbalance was not being priced correctly, I think I have Magic at about +215, and I stopped betting it at +184. So this will be a big one if I can get it, and I need Suggs back in a big way.
Yep, indeed. Okay, question from Stephen Garrett. At the risk of being repetitive, I have two. What resources can a casual tennis fan use to understand players' strengths and weaknesses on different surfaces? And two, are Maxi and White false favorites for most improved player? Thanks. Let's start with the most improved player one, just because we're talking basketball, and then I'll throw to you on tennis. But we've talked about this a bit offline, had a discussion in a thread with some other people about this. I think this is the most mispriced awards market at the moment, where I don't think there is any reason for Tyrese Maxey to be favored over Coby White for most improved player. And I think a thing that I've gotten better at over the journey is kind of divorcing my own opinion about on a player winning on merit or not versus just what are the voters going to vote for, because that's what we're ultimately betting on. And I just, from everything that I've seen and heard from voters, and also just voter types, like guys who have had votes in the past or are beat writers who are somewhat representative and are writing columns or on podcasts where they've actually gone through a process and thought this out, everything that I've heard and seen is shifting towards Coby White. I think you just take a step back and look at their cases. Maxey has increased his scoring by 5.7 points per game, and his efficiency has fallen off. He's now below league average shooting efficiency, whereas Coby White has increased his scoring by 10 points per game, and he's doing it on career best efficiency, and importantly, with a higher true shooting percentage than Maxey. So he's a more efficient scorer. I think the other thing too is that a big element of most improved player is like how surprising or unexpected the improvement was. I don't think anyone is surprised that Maxey is doing this. Like, this is like linear expected improvement. And with Coby White, like, this guy, and I just tweeted this out before, but Coby White was like Shake Milton before the season. Mm-hmm. And look, I don't think Coby White is an amazing basketball player or anything, but he's an efficient, decent basketball player who's now like positive EPM. Like, he's having a really good year. He's leading the NBA in minutes. And it's just a more surprising development. I think he's got a better story as well now. Bulls started, 5-14, and they're like, I think, 25-20 since then, thereabouts. They've saved their season without LaVine and Lonzo, whereas Maxey, like, the team is a heavy favorite to fall into the play-in. Seems like he's losing steam. So I don't know why Maxey is more likely to win the award than White. People also just have an issue with like 20 point per game scorers existing and then winning the award like the following year, where Ja Morant was off ballot like 50 times. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was left off ballot a fair bit as well. So I think that Kobe is going to be on almost every ballot. I think that he's going to come close with Tyrese for first places, and then I think he's going to, you know, handily beat him on seconds and thirds. But what do you think?
Have you seen Kobe White's plus minus in the clutch, Jay?
Yeah, he's got a better plus minus than DeRozan in the clutch.
He's got a better plus minus than Jokic, better plus minus than Shea. Like, are we in the right conversation here? I'm about waving the white flag on Jalen Williams being able to get there, on Kuminga being able to get there. Like, the candidacy needed to really, really catch fire out of the All-Star break, and it didn't. And the candidacy for Kobe White, while it can be attacked, I think is definitely stronger than Maxey's as currently constituted. Philly looked very likely to me to be in the play-in, which I think is a problem for them. And really a problem for any of those guys getting awards. Philly, the kind of the cold water that is kind of on that franchise and the stink on that franchise in the wake of the Embiid injury, I think is sort of the X factor here. It's not being priced correctly. Yeah, I think white flag up. It's Kobe White time.
Yep, Kobe White time indeed. I think, and look, we could be wrong, but I think he should be like minus 150 to win the award. And he is like double that price in the market. And Maxey, yep. I think, yeah, Maxey can definitely win. My read could be wrong on his appeal, but I've got him plus 185, and I've got the field. The field is basically Kuminga and J-Dub, and I think they should each be like 40-1. That type of range. So I wouldn't put a line through them, but I think it's pretty dire on that front. The other part of Stephen's question, Drew, what resources can a casual tennis fan use to understand players' strengths or weaknesses on different surfaces?
Okay. Love this question, Stephen. And the best resource for anyone trying to understand anything about any tennis player is tennisabstract.com. The great Jeff Sackman does a tremendous job of just curating just raw data for consumption. If you go to tennisabstract.com, he's got kind of a there's no opinion involved in creating an ELO rating. And if you specifically look at only matches performed on a given surface, hard, clay, grass, and compare those ELOs, the raw ELOs, to their total ELO, you'll get an immediate, you know, snapshot of, okay, player strength is much better on clay than on hard court. And then if you click through that, a given player where you're seeing that, and you look at their, they will tell you, players will tell you through their history of tournaments they're competing what they prefer, right? If a guy is elected to go to South America to play in, Cordoba, Buenos Aires and Rio, instead of, you know, performing on, you know, going to the indoor, you know, hard court swing in Rotterdam, Marseille and Lyon, you know, I can't remember what the third one is now, but Montpellier. And it's a guy that's from, you know, Europe. And you're like, well, he's specifically going out of his way to play clay. Like, he's telling you something. And I think then, you know, you can kind of look at specific splits. And what you really want to kind of focus on is hold percentage and break percentage on a given surface. Players that are serve dominant will tend to want to play on harder surfaces, play better on faster surfaces. I say harder, faster. You have to kind of look at tournaments and their ace percentage to tell you that there's actually kind of two hard courts in reality. There's fast hard court and slow hard court. And slow hard court is a little bit in between clay and you know, fast hard court. Obviously, it's an intermediate type of step. I think ultimately, if you're a very strong server, your whole percentages and will stand out at the top of the list on hard court. And if you're a particularly good returner, your return win points won and your break percentage is going to stand out, and that's mostly going to be on the slower hard courts in the clay. So I think ultimately, kind of parsing the data through who is serving well, who is breaking at a high percentage, where are the players playing, and then just looking at the raw ELO differences on Tennis Abstract, which again, there's no opinion in that. That is literally just who did you beat and what surface was it on and how good was that player and how good are you? It's just like chess. So I think ultimately that's kind of the key for anyone who's looking to try to understand what's going on with player strengths on surface.
Yep, no, that makes sense to me. Tennis Abstract is a really good resource just for, not as, you wouldn't take it as gospel in terms of definitely make a bet because Tennis Abstract says so, but it's very good at making you ask the right questions to evaluate what you are going to bet. All right, this week, the best on the PGA Tour take on TPC Sawgrass for the 50th time for the Players Championship. Don't miss the best golfers in the world Thursday through Sunday on NBC Golf Channel. And all-round streaming on Peacock. Comcast Business is a proud partner of the Players Championship in addition to Optum and Morgan Stanley.
Hey, Fidelity. How can I remember to invest every month?
With the Fidelity app, you can choose a schedule and set up recurring investments in stocks and ETFs.
Oh, that sounds easier than I thought.
You got this.
Yeah, I do. Now, where did I put my keys?
You will find them where you left them.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
All right, let's bring in our good friend, the usually blazered man, Denny Carter, who is sans blazer today.
Not today. Sadly.
Good to see you, Denny. It was good to the three of us to catch up in Las Vegas and share some Mexican beers, which was great.
Yeah, absolutely.
But let's talk about golf, as you are a big golfman. let's start with just how do you approach this tournament? How do you approach the course particularly?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys. I really appreciate it. I'm a long-time golf head and get really into the metrics of it. Like with football, I've never watched golf. I just watch the dots go back and forth and then look at the numbers afterwards. So, I mean, you know, with this tournament, it's similar to how I approached the Arnold Palmer because that course was so challenging and had such high rough. You really want to put an emphasis on driving. I'm putting this novel thing, putting the ball in the fairway. And I find that when I can identify guys who can consistently do that, last week it was Shane Lowry, for instance, Corey Connors, some other guys who finished in the top 20. I think that you can identify values for the week. So for the players, I actually have three metrics to look at, which is bogey avoidance, strokes gained on approach, and then good drive percentage. And that really, that good drive percentage is not just hitting in the fairway. It's you know, hitting it in the right part of the course. It's not hitting it so far out that you have to chip out or hit it out of bounds or whatever. So it is it's a critical part of the formula for how to find guys who are putting it in play and then ball striking well enough to get you there. I don't really look too much at putting. Maybe that's a little bit of a blind spot. But I do have some guys that pop in all three of these categories this week.
No, I love it. Bogey avoidance is a perfect proxy for what you're describing, which is course management, right? And that's exactly. Not something that's accounted for in Data Golf, for instance. But one of the things that is accounted for in Data Golf, and this is a little bit of a softball here, so I'm setting you up, I guess.
All right.
The TPC Sawgrass is sort of the outlier when it comes to course history mattering, right? You can see a lot of examples of guys who have lit this place up and then the next year just stink out the joint. Yeah. And I guess, do you take any type of kind of lessons from that in either downweighting course history at this and finding an edge, or is it simply just kind of baked into the prices at this point?
I do have some weight on that, but really not a lot. I think, you know, in my golf process, particularly with DFS, I would say I tended last season to put a little too much emphasis on course fit. I think that's something that you can kind of get caught up in, and you can lose sight of recent form, which I find to be the thing to look at. Like, and again, it sounds simple, just like putting the ball in the fairway seems good. Also, which guys are playing well headed into this thing? You know, which guys over the last 12 or 16 or 20 rounds are playing well? We're talking about a 1 month or 2 month span, really drilling down on that. And you know, so I'm not trying to get caught up too much with the course history.
Yep. No, I think that is fair. Keen for your thoughts, Denny, on just how to approach Scottie Scheffler as a man, a myth, a betting proposition for our purposes, where it seems like, for lack of a better term, that just kind of every golf tournament is kind of on his racket, so to speak, where if he's going to putt like he did at the Arnold Palmer, then it feels like it's kind of game over. He is plus 550 in the market to win the Players. Data Golf has him at 12.4%, which Drew and I were talking earlier, just kind of seems a bit low. How do you treat Scheffler, and what do you think of his chances kind of relative to market the Players?
Right. So the one thing that made tournaments interesting before the Arnold Palmer Invitational was that Scottie Scheffler couldn't putt. And that's the one thing that kept him from absolutely blowing away the rest of the field. Well, you know, like Happy Gilmore, he learned how to putt at the Arnold Palmer, and he, by the way, he switched putters. He worked hard on his stance. So there were some changes that Scottie Scheffler made headed into that tournament that really paid off, really paid dividends. He was top five in strokes gained on the green at the Arnold Palmer. It was the best putting performance he's had, guys, since last year's U.S. Open, and it's not even close. I will say, though, that I think that his struggles on the green were a little bit overstated by me as well. I would be online complaining about it all the time. But, he's gained strokes on the green in three of his past six events. So, I mean, he's not a hopeless putter, okay? Like, he's not like Luke List, okay? Like, guys who just, like, cannot get it going. I know List recently had a hot streak, but that's over. And so Scheffler is a good putter, and when he's putting well, no one can compete with him. You know, the LIV thing, stripping out so much talent out of the PGA Tour. Now you have like post prime Rory as the main rival to Scottie. I mean, it's tough. I really think Scottie could do something crazy this season and win 6, 7, 8 events, and including this one. I think he should be the prohibitive favorite, obviously.
Yeah, it's amazing the gap. I've been a while since we've seen a gap between one and two this big, because it felt like, you know, the entire golf world got better at the same time. And now with, as you're saying, the defections to LIV, it is a huge gap between Scheffler and number two, Xander Schauffele. Not wouldn't have pulled that out of my head if I didn't have the.
Yeah, and I guess it has Rory at three.
Yeah, weird. Yeah, or second choice, at least for data golf, whatever. Okay, so are there any kind of longer shots that you think kind of check the box of good course management guy, good recent form, who, you know, maybe, you know, tickle like the top five, top 10 market if we think this is maybe a runaway for Scottie?
Yeah, you know, right. So you've already given the tournament to Scottie Scheffler, which seems reasonable. I mean, Scottie Scheffler is you guys know this, is a machine from tee to green. The guy never wavers tee to green. It just depends on if he can make a few putts. And he started, by the way, he started last week's tournament by missing a 3.5-foot birdie putt. So he didn't start it well, but he ended well. I have a few guys who popped. You know, remember the categories that I was looking at specifically for this tournament were bogey avoidance, good drive rates, and then strokes gained on approach over the past 16 rounds. So it's recent form. Keith Mitchell checks in at fourth on good drive rate, eighth on approach, not so much on bogey avoidance, but Keith Mitchell has been playing well. And then you have Doug Gim. I don't know if he's very well known among golf fans, but he might, you know, yeah, Jay's shaking his head, absolutely not. But he might be this week. He coming into this tournament at the Players, he's sixth on approach, sixth in ball striking, and seventh in bogey avoidance. Really good player around the greens, and on this course you do have to get up and down. It was weird to watch the Arnold Palmer and remember, oh yeah, these guys have to be able to get up and down sometimes, because it's not just bang bang bang, you know, 15 birdies in over two rounds or whatever, like we saw the previous week. So this course is tough. Doug Gim plays tough course as well. I do like him a lot.
Okay. And also, it looks like you have Minwoo Lee, my fellow Australian there as well, and Grayson Sig. You've cornered the market on golfers at this tournament who have unnecessary random added letters in their last name. Doug Kim with an H and Grayson Sig with two G's. But what do you think of Minwoo Lee and Grayson?
Yeah, I'll start with Grayson Sig. He's second in bogey avoidance over the past 16 rounds. So again, that stretches about 2 months. And he's sixth on good drive rate. Now he's bottom half of this field in approach. And if you look across the spectrum at like 125 to 150 bucket and then 150 to 175, it's all not great. But again, this is a tournament where in order to have a chance, you have to be able to put it in the fairway. We saw guys last week, and we're going to see similar rough this week where they would have a 100 yard shot to the green, and they would have to chip out of the rough because they just couldn't gouge it out of the rough onto the green. I think that we're going to see that again this week. So a guy like Grayson Sig, I trust this guy for whatever reason, the stats say so, to put the ball in the fairway and give himself a chance. And then Minwoo Lee, you know, he did struggle last week, and that concerns me a little bit. Talking about recent form, I don't know if Minwoo Lee has that recent form, but I do think that he's a decent bet, a decent top 10 bet, top 20 for sure. He tied for sixth in last year's Players Championship, and he's gained strokes off the tee in six straight events. That's mostly because he hits the ball really far, crazy, crazy far. Him and his sister Minji Lee are just bombers. They're just hitting it 30 yards past everyone. But he's not necessarily super accurate. I do worry about him. He also really doesn't have like the short game chops, you know, that a Scheffler has. I mean, no one does, but you know, so I do worry about him a little bit, but I think he could be overlooked in a field like this.
Minwoo Lee, of course, the Australian Open champion of golf. Did you know that, Jay? He won the Fortinet Australian PGA Championship.
Yeah. I did actually say that when I was looking up Minwoo Lee for a segment on Golf Channel a couple weeks ago. Otherwise, I wouldn't have known.
Yeah, he's been hot in general. He finished top three in an Australian event and then top two at the Cognizant Classic. So talk about form being on point. I like that.
And you know, as producer Adam says, Minwoo Lee can hit his high irons around 300 yards, and I actually saw that this past week. He took out, I think it was a driving iron, basically like a two iron, and just crushed it. And the ball flew like 280 yards. It was disgusting. I mean, he truly is like one of the longest guys you'll ever see on tour. And this is a really long course, so that does match up.
Yep, he is the pride of Perth in Western Australia. Launches his drives like Shannon Hearn, the great West Coast Eagles Australian football player, used to launch the ball off the halfback flank, Denny, which
I remember.
4.5 listeners will get the reference to, but that is fine. So everyone can follow Denny on Twitter at CDCarter13. Denny, can you tell people what NFL content you're working on at the moment?
Oh, man, so much, guys. Free agency is in full swing. The legal tampering period is raging at the moment. And we have all sorts of instant reaction videos and articles on Roto World. Check that out. We're going to have updated news throughout the day, into the evening, into tomorrow morning. Folks, we're not sleeping till Thursday. Check it out.
Okay. Very good, Denny. Thank you for coming on. We'll have to have you back on to talk all things Kirk Lanter and Minwoo Lee.
I love that.
Have a great day, mate. We'll speak to you soon.
All right. Bye.
Cheers. All right. Spring training is here, Drew. So for those looking to get ahead on the upcoming MLB season, grab your RotoWorld Baseball Draft Guide. It's loaded with comprehensive positional rankings, projections, and player profiles to ensure your draft is a success. Visit nbcsports.com/draftguide and use code BASEBALL24 to get 10% off at checkout.
Hey, Fidelity. What's it cost to invest with the Fidelity app?
Start with as little as $1 with no account fees or trade commissions on U.S. stocks and ETFs.
That's music to my ears.
I can only talk.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Zero account fees apply to retail brokerage accounts only. $0 commission applies to online U.S. equity trades and ETFs and retail Fidelity accounts. Sell order assessment fee not included. Some account types and securities excluded. Details at fidelity.com/commissions. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE, SIPC.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Before we get a little more tennis on the docket.
West Coast Eagles catching 49.5 points this weekend.
Very, very big old number. yeah, they won. They won the premiership in 2018. They beat my beloved Magpies by one kick, which required with about, I want to say 83 seconds left, Dom Sheed from the right pocket kicking a goal that in real time was probably paying like plus 750 that he was going to slot it. And he went Slotsville. And it was a very depressing day in the Croucher household. But the Pies got it back last October, Drew, with a similar uplifting narrow victory. So it all evens out in the end.
You think they can stay within 50 of the Port Adelaide Power?
Yeah, I don't mind. I would be on the Eagles at the plus 49.5 before taking the minus. Some questions about Port and their list coming off a year where they overachieved last year. But we should talk AFL at some point. I actually have a lot of strong AFL opinions. Maybe we can do an AMA where I ask myself the questions about whether the Greater Western Sydney Giants are actually a juggernaut or a bit of a paper tiger. Giant, if you will.
They're laying 45.5 to the North Melbourne Kangaroos. Unbelievable.
Yeah, there's some bad teams at the bottom. It's kind of like they're the Charlotte Hornets and Washington Wizards. The Kangas and the much maligned West Coast Eagles. All right. Better teams than the Kangaroos and the West Coast Eagles are Liverpool and Man City, who played. There's not much better than like an epic Premier League game towards the end of the season, particularly one like this where sometimes the games are cagey. Like the Man City Arsenal game earlier in the year just kind of sucked. But this one was awesome where it was back and forth. It could have easily been 5-3. And the five probably should have been Liverpool. I got a question in my DMs. I'm not sure if the guy wants to be named, but it was basically, with the Liverpool 1-1 tie, are you still no on Liverpool to win the Premier League? City are plus 110 to win the title. Liverpool plus 200. Arsenal, who currently occupy top spot, are plus 250. And Tottenham and Villa won't be winning the Premier League. But I think the big matchup in this now is Man City play host to Arsenal on the 31st of March in the first matchup between those two teams. Back in October, Arsenal won 1-0 at home, but that was City were missing a lot of players in that one. City will be heavy favourites to beat Arsenal at the end of March. And now, I mean, Liverpool, they'll want a draw in that match. And if they get a draw there, then they're very live. What I was shocked by just how dominant Liverpool were in the second half, where Luis Diaz one-on-one with the keeper. The City, if they do have a weakness, is that they're not that quick. And that was really exposed against Newcastle when they played at Newcastle earlier in the season, even though they pulled it out in the end. And, I mean, this one, they completely lost control of the game. It was very strange to see the, ostensibly the best team in Europe. And a team that, by the way, closed like plus 105 on the three-way money line against Liverpool to win, and Liverpool like plus 240, I want to say. And you got an idea of how shocking the gameplay was in that. So, yeah, Liverpool plus 240, Man City plus 105 on the three-way. And then in the second half, Liverpool flip into favorite in the live market because they were so dominant. And that was it without any red cards. Yes, City lost Edison, but that shouldn't be enough to flip that. So pretty incredible match. But I think that ultimately it was a point earned for City just because they stole it away. And I think they still are the rightful favorite. And I'm not sure Liverpool are going to get that kind of insane energetic lift at Anfield that they did. Like, this team was like barely scraping out victories over relegation teams a couple of weeks earlier. So what do you make, though, of the market now, Drew? Do you think that City got out of jail and will ultimately get it in from here?
Yeah, City got out of jail big time. That was wild. That second half was incredible. And you're right. There is nothing like a high quality Premier League, and especially because of where it falls on the sport on the calendar, right?
Yeah.
Middle of March, middle of the morning on a Sunday. Like, yeah. Don't mind having that at all as far as like high stakes competition going on to watch. And it was quite a watch. I thought in the first half that City was just going to run away with it. And then, yeah, like you said, the disparity was huge. And honestly, City is a tough one right now to nail. There's red flags all over the place with these guys. Speed is, as you mentioned, I don't know that there is a bigger delta among the elite teams when they have possession and when they don't, in terms of like quality of play. It looks like when they are, you know, without possession, it's really, really tough to see how, this team is going to get it done sometimes. And then with possession, it's just like, oh, well, they're an unstoppable force. And I'm struggling to come up with a fair for them right now in a lot of these markets. And that said, I think the fact that you can get them at plus money and they've largely avoided what would have been the disaster of kind of taking a loss to Liverpool at this stage in the calendar would have been tough to overcome. So yeah, I think it's cities to lose. But that said, I'm very, very intrigued to see what this next Champions League draw, where that slots them, because it's the wrong draw here and they could be in a little bit of trouble. I'm playing defense on my Erling Haaland, top scorer in UCL still. And Mbappe getting two as PSG lock in another round is a little concerning, and this is going to be an interesting sweat now.
Yeah, I'm not too worried about Mbappe. I've watched an ungodly amount of PSG of late because I have these ridiculous bets on Stade Brestois to finish top four in Ligue 1, and I need PSG to be knocking off the teams around them, and they just really keep on making a meal of it. They can't beat anyone at the moment, just kind of kings of the aimless draw currently PSG, but I think you'll probably be right there. City would be my bet at current prices. I just think that they're kind of how they're perceived right now is probably less than what they are, just because they've always performed, I think, poorly at Anfield relative to expectations. It's just a really hard place to play. Like, this is Jurgen Klopp's last game at Anfield against Pep, more than likely. And I think there was a huge lift out of that. And City was rattled. Like, teams get rattled sometimes, and they really seemed like they were rattled. And then Pep took off De Bruyne and Alvarez, brought on Kovacic and Doku, and they seemed to get a little bit more control, and they probably saved the title by just hanging on those last 20-25 minutes. So it really should have been a penalty when Doku, when he kicked Alexis McAllister in the chest. Like, can't put your studs up in the box, Jeremy, but got away with it. All right, before we get out of here, last question from the AMA. I_777. How did you get into betting tennis, Drew? And then I'll have to talk some Indian Wells.
Yeah, so I needed the key step in my kind of progression as a player was realizing that I got to the end of a football season where I had done very well, but I just didn't have much to show for it. And I was like, what in the heck happened? I need to take a little bit more accountability here, do a little bit of auditing, and kind of realized, even though I was betting NFL with an edge, I had just this leak of college football in prime time, big time college football games, big time college basketball tournaments in November. And I was like, you know what? Like, I'm spending 90% of my week handicapping the NFL and 10% donking it off with similar stakes into these sports that I'm just not treating as seriously. And I need to, close that gap. So focused specifically on NFL when the NFL was live. But then that had a problem of, well, after the NFL is over, what do you do? And it just so happens that the handshake between tennis and the NFL is perfect in terms of calendar. The Australian Open has it happens right as NFL is winding down in the playoffs. And then you carry through and you basically have daily matches throughout the entire NFL offseason, ending with the US Open, which ends on the first NFL weekend of the season. So it's like a perfect handshake in terms of coming up with a handicap complement to the NFL with the yearly calendar. And so I was like, okay, well, I'll take this more seriously. And so I started searching around for data. You go to like the ATP website and you go to the data or like the, the stats tab on the ATP website. And it's literally like Elo Karlovic, most aces all time. It's like, well, this is not useful whatsoever. And like, you poke around enough on like the high profile websites and you're just like, man, there's no like actually usable data here to come up with fair prices. And then you stumble on Tennis Abstract and you're like, oh, wow. Well, here's just a repository that's bigger than I ever could have dreamed. I poke around a little bit, you find historic odds, and you're like, okay, now we're cooking with gas. And it's just the process of like how difficult it was to get the underlying data needed to build any type of model made it very appealing. Like, oh man, if this is hard for me to find this stuff at all, then there's got to be a better way to actualize it. And so that was kind of the arc of finding tennis as a perfect complement to the NFL. And I think it's going to be one of the higher growing. It's second or third highest handle worldwide after soccer and cricket. So it's not a small market whatsoever. It's pretty efficient. And, you learn that the hard way as you kind of go up handicapping tennis. But I absolutely love the volume you can get down. I love the mano a mano, woman v woman, only two people involved in a singles match. Kind of fleshing out the edges is extremely fun. Indian Wells has been a joy so far. Like, really, really fun tennis has been played, despite the fact that Elena Rybakina withdrew before the tournament even started. That's a problem. And Nadal withdrew before the tournament started. That was a bummer. Was very interested to see if he could carry over some of the form we saw in the exhibitions he played into this tournament, because I thought he was relatively live to win if he was playing that well. It's been, somewhat upset free so far on the men's side. So we're going to have some incredible matches in week two. Yannick Sinner has looked dominant. Alcaraz has looked a little wobbly. Djokovic looks a little laissez-faire. Medvedev seems to have put some of the kind of mental baggage of the loss at the Australian Open behind him. So you have some elite men's players playing well right now, and I think that's going to create a really fun second week. And then the women's side, it looks very much like we are headed for a clash of the titans with the two best players in the world in the final here between Iga and Sabalenka. Sabalenka is not performing especially impressively so far, but it hasn't mattered because she has a very, very soft draw. I don't think realistically she's going to probably drop more than one set between now and when she gets to the final and plays Iga. And I think the conditions slightly favor Iga in terms of just, court speed and some of the X factor stuff. So I think Iga is still the bet to win at price. And I think ultimately the men's side is going to be just superior entertainment for the rest of this week.
Yep, no, that makes sense to me. I think I've gotten some messages lately from people about like wanting to get into betting tennis. And I would say that, and keen for your thoughts, but if you're wanting to like watch one player on the men's or women's side at the moment in terms of from a betting angle and that player being variance, just kind of wanting to get eyes on them, how they're playing, I think that player probably has to be Naomi Osaka, because she is the player who could be, like right now she's, I think she, some places still, she might be like north of 20 to one to win the US Open. I think there are worlds where she's like 5 or 6 to 1 if she, goes on the right trajectory. And I think there's been pretty positive signs there. One thing you said before we get out of here about, the efficiency of tennis markets and being able to get big bets down. And certainly, you're right, it's much easier to do that than betting on Coby White, most improved player. But I was surprised when I started betting tennis a bit more, which was probably 2-3 years ago. And I was surprised by even like Grand Slams. It's not like even on binned accounts in the US, like you can get on to win like 50, 60 grand on NFL lines and totals day of game pretty easily. Like places like Pinnacle aren't taking those type of limits on tennis head-to-heads and stuff. I was surprised that sometimes the limits are only like 15, 20K. Which for professionals betting is, not nearly the size of what you could get down on Man City, Liverpool, or, any NFL game, basically. Yep. And off of that, I was shocked by it, because I just always thought before I really looked into it that, Grand Slam money lines is super efficient markets. But then I'd have people like, yourself and one other, professional betting friend who I talked to tennis a lot about being like, the Wimbledon semi-final between Elena Rybakina and Simona Halep is completely wrong. Rybakina's plus 270 and she should be plus 145. Like, what? And my natural sense was like, that has to be wrong. These guys are just off their heads. But then, and you know, individual results, whatever, we're back and won that in straight sets. But like, how efficient do you think the market actually is, and what are the forces in terms of liquidity informing that efficiency, for particularly for Grand Slams?
Yeah, I think your points are completely correct. Pre-match betting is not as big as it's not. You can't take as big a swing. But that also said, I think the in-play volume can get astronomical.
Sure.
Particularly in some of the exchanges, like the Djokovic Federer final at Wimbledon 2019, I think set the all-time high. It probably got broken since then, but at the time it was all-time high, and there was something like what, like 20? It was several. It was like I think approaching like 100 million matched worldwide on Betfair in like in play, and it's like how like that's crazy. And so I think a lot of you know, a lot of folks who have an appetite to really bet tennis professionally, they end up trading the, you know, trading live. You know, that stuff is, I think, you know, it's a job. you need it. And honestly, like tennis for someone getting into it, in my opinion, it's kind of 50-50 between the likes of the NFL and the NBA. I think the NFL, there are plenty of people that can succeed without having any type of model, without any type of data, maybe, or maybe like 10%, like, you know, surface level power ratings for teams, but they have like, you know, qualitative layers that you can put on matchups in a given week, or mental model stuff that, you know, that helps you find an edge in the NFL. Whereas NBA is the exact other end of the spectrum. It's almost entirely, in my opinion, data crunch. Like there's very little, excuse me, that I think you can get qualitatively to like layer on to really, really, you know, help find an edge in the NBA outside of a few kind of, you know, classical examples like rest and stuff. But the tennis is 50-50 where you need an underpinning that's numerical. You need to have some, you know, fair for what the, you know, what the money line price ought to be. You know, I think you have to have some also watching because there are things that just can't be priced in that you can see in a particular matchup in terms of, hey, this guy's got this, you know, serve solved. This got this tactic solved. This guy doesn't have this solved. This player is carrying an injury and no one's talking about it. Like those types of qualitative stuff in tennis can be kind of huge edges at times. And, you know, the example you gave of Halep versus, you know, Rybakina, like in late stage slams, there's massive volume worldwide, and it's not sharp in a lot of these matches. And I think the kind of anchoring of, you know, this happens in the NBA, anchoring of like previous success that Simona had, Halep had had at Wimbledon was just distorting the entire picture. Like there were four women left in at that time. Halep was the only one who had ever won Wimbledon. So she was an automatic surcharge plus, you know, 25% win probability in every market you looked at. And it's like, this isn't right. She's not playing that well. Like she had a lucky draw to get here. Rebecca is playing much better right now. Ons Jabeur was playing much better. So, you know, there, that type of stuff definitely happens in at the Grand Slam level. And on the women's side in particular, because it's best of three, attaching huge kind of past success is just wildly inappropriate. So I would say that, you know, it's a good kind of mid stakes attack, you know, place to attack if you're into the, you know, if you're a professional player. If you're a large stakes professional player, you're probably looking to try to get involved in play trading wise, because that's it's the perfect sport for that. The swings in a given match can be just so volatile. The volatility is just king in tennis. And, you know, if you're able to dedicate your time to building a model to capture it and then, you know, actually putting the time watching, then I think that's probably a hugely successful endeavor for a lot of people who take this professionally.
Yep. No, I agree 100%. I think tennis is, for me, by far the most interesting live betting, live trading sport, because to your point, like in theory, it should be really easy to model because you have this very kind of controlled environment, isn't the right word, but it's like, you know, there's only two players and you should be like, all right, well, if this guy or this girl closed this price and this is the state of play currently, that should be this price. You simulate it out, but it doesn't work like that because like there are momentum factors that go into models that change prices. And also like the watching thing, there were massive rorts on the Alcaraz-Djokovic matchup in the French Open where it's like, oh, Alcaraz can't, his body doesn't work anymore. Like he's still favored, like a big favorite to hold serve, He's no chance. Like, he's just done. He's completely done. And I'll never forget the US Open final last year, Djokovic Medvedev. Yeah. Djokovic looked like he was physically kind of melting. And I think Djokovic, I want to say he closed like a minus 225 favorite in the final. And he won the first set 6-3. Second set goes to a tiebreak. And Medvedev is up 2-0 in the tiebreak. Djokovic is a setup and it's a tiebreak, 2-0. And Medvedev is favorite to win the match. And it's like, what the hell is going on? Like, this is a very subjective adjustment. Sure enough, Djokovic comes back, wins in straight sets. And that's something where, like, you just have to have eyes on that, because you cannot be making informed decisions unless you're watching the match. And when that kind of stuff is going into pricing, where you can get down to win tens of thousands of dollars, makes it a very fascinating market and a vulnerable one, I think. So definitely a good one to get into for anyone who's just looking to explore a new space.
And honestly, like, if NFL season ends and you think you're going to find an edge betting college basketball and you never run a number to that point in the season, I got bad news for you. You're not.
If you don't
already have the infrastructure built to run player level numbers for the NBA, you're not going to figure it out on February 25th. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. It's also like there's only so many players. There's no different conferences and stuff. There's only so many surfaces. It's a bit more, I think, solvable than trying to go into, figuring out lower level college basketball or whatever. All right, we are done. Don't forget to check out NBCSports.com for more information to help you with your wagers. Thanks to those watching on the NBC Sports YouTube channel. If you're listening to us in podcast form, don't forget to rate and subscribe. And also a reminder to find all your favorite NBC Sports shows on Amazon Music, just head to amazon.com/NBCSports. Thanks to everyone who shot through questions for the AMA. We have lots left over. We'll get to them next week. We might tackle some before then too. But from Jake Croucher and Drew Dinsick, we'll see you soon.
Building a portfolio with Fidelity Basket Portfolios is kind of like making a sandwich. It's as simple as picking your stocks and ETFs, sort of like your meats and other topics, and managing it as one big, juicy investment. Now that's pretty good. Learn more at fidelity.com/baskets. Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE SIPC.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.